Yes, public media.
Hi, friends. Welcome to Bayou to Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today, we are joined by a distinguished author, Bob Mann, who has written a book called Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of a Conservative Icon. We're going to talk about that book, but first, let me tell you just a little bit about Mr. Mann. He was born in Beaumont, Texas. He went to high school in Leesville. Go Wampus Cats. He went to college at NLU, which is now ULM, where he majored in journalism, working with Richard Baxter. Did some grad work at Cal State University, got a master's in history, then began a career as a journalist with the New Star and the Shreveport paper. He went on to become press secretary for Senator Russell Long and then moved over to become press secretary and later state director with John Breaux before finally joining Kathleen Blanco's administration as communications director. He then began a career he's pursued for 13 years, going on 14 at LSU at the Manship School, where he teaches courses in political communication. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pearson. Good to be with you today.
Good to have you. Now, you've written a number of different books over the years, some of which I've known and some of which I haven't known. Perhaps Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds, LBJ, Barry Goldwater, and The Ad That Changed American Politics is the one perhaps many people have heard of. But you've also written A Grand Delusion, The Walls of Jericho, Legacy to Power, and so on. Well, tell me about this new project that is now culminated in this lovely volume, Becoming Ronald Reagan. How did you happen to get interested in this, and was it partly because of a speech that Ronald Reagan made?
Yeah, it was. It really came out of the last book that I wrote, Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds, which was about the 1964 presidential election between Goldwater and Johnson, and the famous Daisy Girl spot that I argue changed American politics. And I was vaguely aware that during that campaign, Ronald Reagan gave a nationally televised speech on the night of October 27th. On behalf of Barry Goldwater, and that was a sensation, probably the best speech that anyone had given in that race on Goldwater's behalf, including on Goldwater on his own behalf. And it really propelled Reagan into the governor's race in 1966 and was the culmination of sort of his preparation for entering public office, going from actor to politician. And I thought, wow, there's got to be a story about this speech. There's got to be a book about this speech that, you know, how did the speech come about, the impact of the speech. And so I decided to write a book about this famous speech. And I realized after I got into it that what I had was not so much as a book about a speech, but a book about the life culminating in that speech, or the preparation for his political career that culminated in this speech. So it really became a story after I got into it about how did this liberal actor, this former labor union president who supported Hubert Humphrey and Harry Truman in 1948 and tried to talk Eisenhower into running for president in 1952 as a Democrat, go in the span of less than a decade from a liberal Democrat to a conservative Republican to the Republican – to 5 years later, the Republican governor of California. It was just a story that seemed to me did not get enough attention in a lot of Reagan biographies, and I thought it was worth a book, and it turned out that it was.
There are a number of things here. You know, based on what you said about Daisy Petal and then about this particular book, it seems like you kind of – one of your – strategies is to look for what you can maybe are linchpins in history and these incidents that are indicative of larger things and get into your study and your what you're writing about through these particularly important moments.
Right. Yeah. That was the approach I took with this very small event, which my agent at the time told me that on the Daisy Girl spot, that's a magazine article. That's not a book. And I sort of took that as a dare. Well, I'm going to show you. And I was able to make it into a book. The same with this, although this I would argue this book is not about the speech as much. I intended it to be, but it really became a larger story about this man's transformation.
Well, let's talk about that. A good bit of the book is focused on Reagan's years as an actor. So tell me about that. Can you separate the actor from the politician? Looking back, what's the relationship between the actor and the politician? Because he was an all-out actor. He was bitten by the bug early.
He was, and he was – One insight that I have after doing this research and watching a number of Reagan movies, that he was a better actor than I think his detractors gave him credit for being. That was that was a way of, I think, his political opponents used against him by just saying he was a bad actor and therefore a bad politician, that he failed at acting, and so he had to go into politics. And I think that is an unfair and very simplistic way of describing Reagan's career. He was not a bad actor. He wasn't the greatest actor, but he wasn't terrible. And during this brief period before the First World War, the Second World War, he was actually one of the highest paid actors in Hollywood. He was not a struggling actor who never had success in his career. He actually had a very successful career that was interrupted by his service in the Second World War. And when he came back, that's when his career floundered, and when he began to gravitate into more political activism. But what I came away also thinking was what I entered the book thinking that Reagan's success as a politician was because of his acting ability, that he played a politician, that he played a role. And I don't believe that's true, at least in the early part of his career. What I found was that Reagan's acting abilities were crucial to his entry into politics because he learned how to deliver lines without having to read from a text. He had a photographic memory. He knew how to memorize a script, and he committed these speeches in his mind mostly to memory. He had some rudimentary shorthand on some note cards, but unlike a lot of public speakers, he didn't read from a text. And so he was able to watch his audience very carefully. He was able to observe how what he said, how people responded in these audiences, what he said. He always kept the lights up. He never wanted the lights down when he was giving a speech. He wanted to really see the audience, wanted to be up close to them. And I think Reagan's acting helped him read audiences, gave him that one-on-one connection. He was able to always maintain eye contact with them in a way because of that photographic memory, because of that ability to remember lines. And he was able to refine his speeches over the years because of that, because he so closely observed the reaction that people had to what he was saying. So that by the time he begins to run for governor, people are marveling, like, my God, this man is so good. It must be because he's an actor. And that's true, but there's so much more to it.
Well, one of the things that was a bit surprising to me as I read your book was about Reagan as the person with encyclopedic interests who knew a lot of stuff, who knew so much that other people in his era, particularly in the 40s and 50s, regarded him as kind of a fount of information and, in fact, looked for ways, some of them, his first wife, looked for ways to turn it off, like, oh, my God, you're boring me with statistics again. But this ran against my image of him as kind of a charming but rather shallow guy.
Yeah, and I was surprised by that too. You talk to people or read about people talking about Reagan off screen, and at dinner parties and social settings. What they say is that he couldn't stop talking about politics, or he couldn't stop talking about some book he had read or some article he'd read. He was fascinated by public affairs, and because he had this photographic memory, he was able to cram and retain a lot of knowledge and regurgitate it in ways that frankly bored a lot of people. I mean, they're, you know, the Hollywood types, especially on set between scenes, they just want to relax and decompress. The last thing they wanted to do was see Ronald Reagan coming at them with talking about the price of peas in Portugal, and that's what he would do. And so he bored a lot of people with it because he was just so fascinated by it. You know, you talk these people like Doris Day and June Allison and a lot of these movie stars that people of our age would be familiar with. They say very early on, I knew this guy was destined for politics because that's all he wanted to talk about at these dinner parties and on the set. He was really well read. He was a dilettante in a way. He wasn't deeply steeped in policy. He had a degree in economics, but he was not an economist. He was not a policy expert. But he was interested in it enough that he could carry on a decent conversation with people about it.
Yeah, and I think that's something that caused me to re-examine my view of him. And let me just say that I think most actors, given the chance to be as successful as Ronald Reagan was in the long term of pictures, I mean, he's in the top 1% of all actors if you add everybody in, or maybe even higher than that. So, I mean, he certainly had an illustrious career.
Well, not only that, but, you know, he especially on television. Yeah. You know, in the '50s, he was one of the better known television actors.
I think my early television experience, I remember Death Valley days as a kid, you know, and remembering his kind of folksy, you know, introductions mm-hmm. to those yeah. shows and so on. Let's talk about his transformation, though. So he's really crazy about politics. He talks about it all the time. But he's talking about it oftentimes from a New Deal Democratic point of view. So how does that work? How does he move from becoming a New Deal Democrat to becoming a conservative Republican, and in fact, a very conservative Republican?
Reagan said that after the war that that he began to reexamine the role of government in the lives of Americans. He began to sort of see big government in ways that he had not seen before, which is kind of crazy because if there was ever big government, it was in the New Deal era leading up to the war and during the war. But for some reason, it didn't really – he worshipped FDR, but it didn't really occur to him, he said, to hate big government until after the war. I think that I take him at his word that that was part of it, but I think there was a much bigger – a much more profound event in Reagan's life that began to push him toward a more conservative view about national politics, and that was his fight against communism in Hollywood as a very active member and then president of the Screen Actors Guild when many in Washington were going after Hollywood and Reagan defending Hollywood and being a part of trying to root out communism. And not that there was a—I don't think there was a communism wasn't a partisan issue. Democrats and Republicans were both very much opposed to communism in the United States in the post-World War II era. But that pulled Reagan into the political fray in a way that he began talking about politics that in a way he'd not talked before. And he fell in with some Republicans. He fell in with Republicans who were making hay, Richard Nixon and people like that, who were making hay about the McCarthy era, and that began to pull him into it in ways that began his active involvement in politics.
Wow. Well, that's certainly fascinating. We're going to talk about that some more in just a second. We are talking today with professor and pundit and author Robert Mann. He wrote a book called "Becoming Ronald Reagan: The Rise of a Conservative Icon," and we're going to talk some more in just a moment.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through KRVS program sponsorship. For more information, call 337-482-1437 and thank you.
I love short fiction. Short fiction is like close-up magic. This is Neil Gaiman. Get your story fixed this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
6 p.m. Friday on KRBS.
Hello, and welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. I'm your host, Pearson Cross. Today we're talking to Bob Mann, who's written a fascinating new book called Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of a Conservative Icon. Just as we were going to break, we were talking about anti-communism and Ronald Reagan's work in the Screen Actors Guild and all those things. You know, in your book, you talk about how he led a strike or he was a proponent of strikes or something. That's labor activity. That's something that I had always, kind of aligned with pretty far leftist, even socialist kind of actions. But it turns out that anti-socialism, anti-communism is one of the themes of his life. Could you square that up for me a little bit?
Yeah. I think this is the consistent – Reagan changed a lot when he was a Democrat, liberal Democrat to a conservative. But one thing that did not change, the consistent aspect of his life from the beginning of his political activism to the end of his life, was – his opposition to communism and totalitarianism, authoritarianism across the world stage. Communism drew him into politics, and it remained, as I say, the constant part of his life that when he became more of a social conservative, an economic conservative, he could still talk about his distaste for communism with Democratic friends because they shared that hatred. But there were parts of his ideology that began to gravitate away. He began to disassociate himself from Democrats as he became more politically active, and when his acting career collapsed and he had to find other work. The book really, to me, is the story of the impact of the influence of General Electric, and when he became more of a corporate spokesperson instead of the person lobbying for a better deal for union workers, he became the guy on the other side of the desk in a way for this corporation, and that's what changed him dramatically.
Well, let's talk about that. The part of the book that, I don't know, just really worked hard well for me, I mean, it's a great book and a very good read, and I certainly recommend it. One part that particularly I liked was the part about the focus on the General Electric television theater and Ronald Reagan being the host of that and then going around and speaking to all the various plants of GE around the country and then the role that kind of played in his later developments. So I wonder if you could kind of flesh that out for our listeners. How did that work and what did it do for Reagan's development?
Well, Reagan gets this job. His acting career is gone. He can't get a job as an actor in any decent movies. He's desperate for money. And there's a chapter in the book about how he gets the job and the impact that has on him later. But he gets this job hosting General Electric Theater, which is a fairly new program that General Electric is putting on CBS on Sunday nights, and he's going to be the host of it, where he just kind of presides over this, towards an introduction and a closing, and maybe acts in 10 or so episodes in a year. And as part of the job, though, he's not just hosting the show. He's also asked to be a goodwill ambassador for the company and travel around visiting over a number of years, visiting all of 135 or so GE plants around the country. And most of these plants are in fairly small towns around the United States, you know, middle America. And over the years, he begins to do more than just visit the plants. He begins to speak to these local chambers of commerce and community chest and United Way groups and local organizations, and starts giving, in the beginning, speeches about Hollywood and eventually speeches about politics. And that, to me, is where you really see Reagan become the conservative that we know of him today. And he's working for a company, General Electric, that one person in the book describes as being sort of to the right of the John Birch Society. I mean, this was a very conservative corporation that was in many ways very anti-union. And Reagan sort of imbibes deeply in the philosophy, the economic philosophy of this company. He wants to do a good job of being the goodwill ambassador to this company. So I think that began to change him. But more than anything else, I think, he was going around speaking to middle America, these chambers of commerce. What was he going to, there's just no way that he's going to make a robust argument for political liberalism to some little small town Kiwanis club. I mean, I think that what happens, where I see Reagan changing is not that he sees something after the war, that he really has a strong reaction to big government, that even General Electric ideology changes him as much as the audiences he was speaking to. He wanted to appeal to those people. He wanted their affection. He wanted their support. He wanted them to love him. And so the audiences, I think, influenced him as much as anything. He wanted to tell them what they believed. He wanted to echo what they cared about. He wanted to reflect their values. And I think that gradually over a number of years, those audiences began to influence him and made him into the conservative that we know him today.
You know, I couldn't help when I heard when I read that part in your book, and I was thinking about it, that, you know, as you describe it, it was kind of a fortuitous occasion when he was going around the country speaking to the plants, workers in the plants, and it was a big deal. He'd go through the whole plants. It was exhausting. But somebody had the bright idea, well, while you're in town, why don't you give a talk – to the Chamber of Commerce, and it was a huge hit, as you describe it.
Yep.
And then apparently that was part of the regular thing, so that wherever he went across the country, he's also talking to groups of mostly conservative, well-heeled, affluent groups of people around the country. And so he's getting feedback. And then also what your book points out is that he's an actor. He loves applause. He loves those lines. And he really assiduously calls his speeches for the lines that get him applause or don't get him applause, which left me very much thinking about another figure in American politics today. I know you can't imagine who that might be. But anyway, I thought it was all very interesting, you know, the way he's crafting a message. The message turns out to be kind of one from his employers, but also the one that resonates with middle American workers.
Yeah, and he has this amazing system of he creates these cards, these little index cards, these stack of cards, and on every card he has, and I have a page in the book where I have a reproduction of his weird little shorthand, but he has a shorthand on every card that is a prompt for maybe a riff of 4 or 5 minutes about some policy or maybe a joke or a story. And he's able to shuffle these cards around over a number of years to create what became really the perfect speech, which becomes that speech he gives for Barry Goldwater on national television. And he called it the speech. His people around him called it the speech. And it was perfected over years and years and years of giving the speech, seeing a line that didn't work, throwing the card out, putting a new card in there till he finally got the line, the story, the anecdote that really resonated with the audience. And he's looking at the audience in the eyes. He can see. He knows when these stories are resonating. He knows not just from the applause at the end of the speech. He can see it in their eyes when he's giving the speech. This is working. Keep this here. Keep this here. And so he really perfects the speech so that the first time that most Americans hear him speak in a political context is on national television in October of 1964. And they're thinking, oh, my God, where'd this guy come from?
Can we set the stage for that? So how did he happen to be on TV and giving that speech at that time?
He gives the speech to a fundraiser for Barry Goldwater earlier in the fall in Los Angeles.
And that's fall of
1964. And there are a bunch of rich Californians who are supporting Barry Goldwater, friends of Barry Goldwater, who hear this speech and say, oh, my God, we've got to put the speech on television. You know, they were frustrated with Goldwater's inability to make the argument for his own candidacy. And when they hear Reagan give this speech, which many of them had not heard before, they were just flabbergasted, just blown away. And they pull Reagan at the end of the dinner. They pull Reagan aside and say, would you give this speech on national television? And about a month later, Reagan, they go into a studio in Burbank. They recreate a sort of the scene of a rally, get all these volunteers in. And Reagan gives a speech. They record a 30-minute speech. And Reagan gives the speech he's been giving for years. And they raise a lot of money for it.
An extraordinary amount of money. $23 million in today's dollars in after the speech.
It's a ton of money that flows in, and this group of California businessmen raise money for not only Reagan to give a speech, but for John Wayne to give a speech and to air, you know, all kinds of other programming on behalf of Goldwater that almost rivaled what Goldwater himself was spending on his own campaign, and they became sort of a shadow advertising effort on behalf of Goldwater. And I think if you look at Goldwater's spots that he was airing for himself and what Reagan and others were doing for him, the Reagan effort, the Reagan associated effort was much better than what Goldwater's campaign was producing.
Yeah, Goldwater seemed to be a pretty much amateur organization, as you quote his campaign director. He'd never done TV before, so it was new to him. You know, here he is. He's wading into it in a national campaign. That's something that's crazy. Your book points out the importance of Southern California and Orange County for this kind of hotbed of conservatism. Most people don't think about California as conservative. You know, it's the state where all the seeds and the nuts, you know, kind of go to. But in fact, that's not the case. There's some bastions of conservatism. And Ronald Reagan was kind of part of that, wasn't he?
Ronald Reagan was the place where he found his most enthusiastic support when he was launching his political career. That's where a lot of these people who were supporting Barry Goldwater in 1964. Orange County was growing explosively. It was, you know, sort of I don't know if you call it a suburb, but it was an area outside of, you know, south of L.A. that was growing really fast. in the 50s and 60s, and it became this – it really did become this hotbed of conservatism, one of the most conservative, reliably Republican counties in America. Strangely enough, it doesn't have a single Republican representing it in Congress now. It's like the rest of California, fairly Democratic. But for a generation or more, it was the epicenter of America. It was the birthplace in many ways of the American conservative movement that eventually led to Ronald Reagan's election as president.
Now, let's talk about another big speech. We're talking, by the way, if you just tuned in today, to Bob Mann, who wrote a book called Becoming Ronald Reagan, and we're talking about that book. This is the speech that he gave. Of course, Goldwater's campaign went nowhere, although it didn't reflect badly on Ronald Reagan. Everybody said, man, if only Ronald Reagan had been running, we might have had a chance. But then he does kind of run against Gerald Ford. He comes up short, but then there's a moment where he gives a speech. Maybe you can talk about that.
Yeah, so Reagan does run for president briefly in 68, but he really makes his first big effort when he's a year past his governorship, when he's now former governor of California, running for president against Gerald Ford, the incumbent president, in 76. And he comes within a hair of defeating Ford at the convention. And at the end of this convention, everybody thinks it's over. Reagan gets called down by Ford to the dais to give this supposedly impromptu speech, which Reagan gives to sort of close out the convention. And again, Reagan gives this speech that blows everybody away, has many of the delegates crying. They stood during the whole thing. They leave that night and the next day thinking, oh, my God, maybe again we've nominated the wrong person for president, and they probably did. But it just struck me that there's within the span of 14 years, 12 years, I should say, Ronald Reagan gives the best speech by far of two presidential campaigns in which he is not the nominee. And and in both cases, the speech he gives, people are blown away by what seems like either the impromptu nature of it, or they're impressed because, my God, we've never heard anything like this. And yet Reagan is so thoroughly prepared for the moment, but seemingly giving it off the cuff, which is, I think, the brilliance of Reagan's communication ability, is he's able to appear like this is just springing out of his soul, when actually these are lines that he's rehearsed, that he's thought about for years. He knows exactly what he wants to say, but he gives it with such ease. And to make it look like these are my musings here.
Well, that's one of the things that was said, that you said in your book, is that, you know, Reagan and Goldwater, for example, could say the exact same thing, and people would hear Reagan and go, oh, yeah, well, that's nice. And they'd hear Goldwater say it, and they go, oh, my God, what is that?
Yeah, you know, Reagan had a way of, you know, he was avuncular. He was kind. He wasn't a vicious, mean politician. He didn't attack people personally. And he enjoyed speaking to these audiences. He loved that. He was not Reagan was in many ways not an approachable man on a one-on-one situation. Didn't have really a lot of close friends, but he loved an audience. Goldwater hated that part of the campaigning, and it showed.
We have about a minute left, so we're talking once again to Bob Mann, Becoming Ronald Reagan, his new book. So who should buy this book?
Well, you know, I think if you grew up hating Ronald Reagan or disliking Ronald Reagan or thinking Ronald Reagan was a lightweight, an amiable dunce, you ought to read this book, because it's gonna change your mind about who he was. It won't change your mind about his politics, but it's gonna change your mind about the person and how he came into politics.
Well, I think that's probably what we want from history and from the kind of book you've written, and that is to educate us more about a great national figure that means a lot to a lot of people. We've been talking today to Bob Mann, who's coming to talk about his brand new book. I read it. I recommend it. It's called Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of a Conservative Icon. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Pearson.
Bayou to Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, or members. To listen to a podcast of the interview we just heard, go to krvs.org.
You want a truth? Scooter? I stared down at the mic on the doghouse. When you close your eyes, what do you see? Nothing yet. but the dark stares back.
A Hidden Life, this week on Selected Shorts from PRX.
Coming up Friday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.